Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I do. So the main idea in geometric group theory is that you start with these fairly abstract objects, groups, which are abstract algebraic objects, and you try to understand them by modeling them with geometric objects. You try and get a geometric picture of your group and then use the geometry to tell you something new about the group, which is difficult to do in a strictly algebraic way. It turns out that these geometric objects, some of the geometric objects that arise in studying groups, also are excellent ways of modeling certain physical systems. And I thought that rather than talk about abstractions today, I would concentrate on this side of the picture, and I'm actually going to say very little about groups in today's talk, and I'm rather going to use the physical systems as a motivation, as an excuse to introduce these interesting geometries and then talk about the geometry. So I won't be saying a whole lot about what I do with them. Okay, so what do we mean by modeling? Well, everybody knows that mathematics is a good way to model real-world phenomena. And most people, when you think modeling, mathematical modeling, I mean, what do you think of? Well, maybe functions, graphs, equations that relate various quantities to each other, and by studying these equations or these graphs, we learn more about the systems we're studying. Well, and today I want to talk about, and I think this has become increasingly important as a way of modeling things, many complex systems are best modeled using geometric objects, and the geometry itself can then tell us something about the system. So I want to talk about a particular example of that today. Well, here's my goals. My goals, the talk really has two parts. The first part is to talk about how we build these geometric models, and I'll be using a particular example from robotics today to talk about constructing such models, and then to look at those geometries, to play with the geometry a little, see what properties it has, and how those properties can tell us something about the system we started with. So that's what we're going to be talking about. Okay, so we'll begin with building the models. Let me start with an example from biology. We will get to our robotics in a minute. So let's start with an example from biology. So in genetics, people are trying to understand how, the biologists are trying to understand how various genes interact with each other. So you have a bunch of genes that seem to have something to do with regulating some system. And it appears that when certain genes are more active, producing whatever protein they produce, this may stimulate or suppress the action of another gene. Right? And we'd like to understand what those interactions are. So how could we model this geometrically? Well, supposing we put a point, a node, for each gene, and then we put an arrow between two of these nodes if this gene affects this gene in some way. Whenever this gene is active, it causes something to happen. And this gene, of course, what happens? We would probably want to decorate this with more information to describe, does it made with pluses or minuses to say it either stimulates or suppresses the other gene. So this alone doesn't tell us everything, but it gives us some information about how genes interact with each other. So we can ask questions like, are there stable states? Are there feedback loops? Are there various types of paths or loops that we see in the graph will result in certain types of interactions happening or not happening between the genes. So it gives us a geometric picture of understanding how these genes interact with each other. Well, I would call this thing a one-dimensional model. So it's one-dimensional because it's made up of points, which are zero-dimensional, and lines, which are one-dimensional. So that's a one-dimensional geometric model of a system. The systems I'd like to talk about today involve higher dimensional objects, can't really be modeled effectively using only one dimensional things, right? So let's take a look at this. This particular example comes from robotics, and I'm following the work of Rob Grice and Valerie Peterson, but there's a bunch of related work by other people, but it's their particular description of this model that I'm going to be describing. So this is what we want to do is we have some robot made up of lots and lots of small moving parts, like that little robotic hand I showed that was on my cover. So we have something, it's a robot, but it has tons of lots of little moving parts, maybe hundreds of them. And what we want to do is understand how those parts move in relation to each other and how we get the robot hand, say, from this position to some other position. Right? How's the best way to move to reconfigure the robot from one configuration to another? Right. So rather than the robotic hand, which is a little too complicated for me to draw, we're going to work with a slightly simpler system. We're going to think of a robot. My particular robot in these drawings is simply going to consist of a bunch of hexagons in a plane. And what this robot can do is it has joints at the corners, has little joints, and any hexagon can rotate along one of those corners to a new position, right? So they can freely, so this robot can reshape itself. I mean, imagine, I haven't drawn very many, but imagine lots more hexagons attached to each other. And this robot could shape itself into all sorts of different shapes by little hexagons rotating one after another along a vertex. Okay, so I want to rotate this green one into a new position. So you see what it's done is it's rotated across this corner into a new position, a single rotation. So I'll call that R, that rotation. Now I want to rotate the purple one into a new position. Right? It's rotated upward into a new position. Okay. But maybe I want to rotate the green one and the purple one. Well, luckily, they're going into positions that don't interact. I mean, they're not going to run into each other. There's no harm in doing both of those rotations. And we can see that it wouldn't really matter if we did the green one and the purple one, or the purple one then the green one, we'd end up in the same place. And what's more, since they're not in each other's way, we actually could have done them both simultaneously. There's no reason not to go straight across from here to here and do them simultaneously. Right? So what's the natural model for this? The natural model for this is simply a square. So what's happened, if we go back for a second, whoops, that's not what I meant to do, is that our various shapes, our various configurations of the robot are now simply corresponding to single points. Each point is a different shape for the robot. The edges are corresponding to single rotations, and the fact that the square is filled in is a message that it's okay to go diagonally across and do them both simultaneously. Right, the statement that I can travel directly from here to here without having to do one operation at a time. All right? Okay, well, let's keep going. Maybe I want to move the green one again. All right, let's move the green one again. Well, if I move the green one again, I see that I get another square. And this square is adjacent to this square because they share two configurations, etc. I can move the purple one again, and I get another square, maybe down here. Or I could keep going, and each time I move something, I get some new piece that I have to add onto my model. Okay. Well, let's make it more interesting. Now I want to move three pieces. I want to move the green one, I want to move the purple one, and I want to move the yellow one. Now, I'm going to move them in such a way that they don't run into each other, which means I can do whichever one I want first. In fact, I can do them all at once. And what do you suppose we get here? Right. So the back face there was exactly what we started with before. And as we come forward, we see this one rotating into a new position. But again, because these moves are independent of each other and don't conflict with each other, we can go diagonally across this cube if we so choose. Or in any way around or diagonally across. Okay, so we would represent this set of moves by a three-dimensional cube. And why stop there? We might have four independent pieces that could move as they wished, or five independent pieces, or six independent pieces. And, of course, what are we getting is four-dimensional cubes, five-dimensional cubes, dot, dot, dot. Now, I suspect everybody in this audience won't blink an eye at that idea of four-dimensional cubes and five-dimensional cubes, but just in case, let me just say that mathematicians really are just as happy in four dimensions or 104 dimensions as they are in one, two, or three, because, of course, what all we mean by a cube here is just Well, I probably don't have to say anything about this to this audience, but I'll go through this slide quickly. So a one-dimensional cube is simply a line segment. We can think of it as all the numbers between 0 and 1. A two-dimensional cube is then any point in a two-dimensional cube requires us to give two numbers, the distance along here and the distance along here. A three-dimensional cube requires three numbers between 0 and 1 to give a position. Well, what's a four-dimensional cube? It's just four numbers between 0 and 1. Or a five-dimensional cube is five numbers between 0 and 1. So we can represent mathematically higher dimensional cubes are simply not a problem. Right? They're simply just as easy in higher dimensions as in lower dimensions. And not only that, using the idea of vectors, as viewing these things as vectors, we have a perfectly good notion of distance, angles, geometry, etc. in a higher dimensional cube. So geometry inside a higher dimensional cube is no problem. We know exactly what we mean. We know what the shortest path between two points is, how far it is between two points. We can do all the geometry we want in higher dimensions. Okay, so we can, going back to our robot. We take our robot, we look at all the different shapes the robot can take, we look at all the different ways to get from one shape to another by a single move, and we fill in all the squares and higher dimensional cubes which are allowed, in other words, in which there's nothing runs into each other, which are independent moves and one could be done simultaneously. All right? And we get some object made up of lots of cubes of all different dimensions, right, in which the points, the vertices, the nodes are represent different shapes of the robot. The cubes represent sets of independent moves, and now let's go past that. What if we have a point here and a point way over here in our space? Well, now if I want to know how that corresponds to what? A shape of the robot and another shape of the robot. And now a path between those two points corresponds to a sequence of moves that will get me from this shape to this shape, right? So paths correspond to ways, choices of ways to reconfigure the robot to tell the robot how to change from this shape to that shape. And the distance between things corresponds to, well, time or at least complexity of getting from here to here. So if they're close together, it means I can get there very quickly, do all the necessary moves at once or whatever. And if they're very far away, it means it's going to take a long sequence of moves to get me from here to here without pieces crashing into each other. Okay? All right. So now we can see the geometry beginning to correspond to questions about the robot itself. Caution. As we go through, we're going to start talking about the geometry of these spaces in a minute. And caution, remember these things are not just a few squares nicely fit together. They can be very complicated. I can't even draw one that's complicated. But remember, they can have many, many cubes, all different dimensions, fit together in all sorts of crazy ways. And just keep in mind that they may not be things that are easily drawn or easily pictured. Okay, so they're quite complicated. Even though the cubes themselves are simple things, the way they fit together could end up being quite complicated. Okay, I think I already sort of said this. The geometry can be complicated, but studying the geometry is a interesting and worthwhile thing to do because it can answer such questions as what's the most efficient way to get from one configuration to another? Are there several choices of ways, or is there basically one way to do it? How do we find that? How long will it take, etc.? Okay? All right. Before we move on to the second part of the talk, we're actually going to talk about what the geometry looks like of these spaces. But first, I wanted to just mention a couple of other places in which these cube complexes come up, a few other applications of these same types of spaces made out of cubes. One of my favorites comes from, again, from biology. It's a paper from a few years ago by Valera, Holmes, and Boltman, in which they showed that the collection of phylogenetic trees representing the history of species can be modeled with cubes. So let me say a little bit about this. I can't go into this in detail, but I just wanted to mention it because it comes up later in the talk. So if you have a number of different species and you'd like to know what their ancestral history is, in other words, when did this species break off of this species you know, which have the closest ancestors? How long ago did they split apart? So what you do is these days is you study their DNA and you look for similarities and differences in the DNA. And from that DNA data, you try to reconstruct an ancestral tree, what's called a phylogenetic tree, which shows what broke off from what at what point in time. Well, the problem is that data is really statistical in nature. It doesn't determine a unique tree. You get all this data and it doesn't really, it's, first of all, if you check, you know, three different cats and dogs, you won't get the same answer. You get a bunch of statistical data. And so you get a bunch of possible trees that maybe could model this data. And the question is, often, what's the best one? What do you mean by best? And what's the best one? What's the best model for this sort of statistical data? Well, what they showed is that you could look at all possible trees and model it using a cubical complex and then discuss the notion of best geometrically. And I'm going to come back to that when we do the geometry. All right. So this idea of statistical data represented on a cubical complex is an interesting one. All right, so, and finally, although I said I wouldn't talk about it, I couldn't resist putting in one slide about geometric group theory, because this is what I use these things for. So, as I explained, we start, in geometric group theory, we start with something fairly abstract. So, here's a group. What's a group? Well, a group is a set together with some kind of operation that allows you to combine elements of the set, like an addition or a multiplication, or some way of combining two elements of the set to get another element. How do you describe, if I want to describe a group to you, well, there are some familiar groups like integers under addition or this or that, but if it's some not so familiar group, how do you describe it? How do I hand you a group? All right? Well, there are many ways. Here's a typical one called generators and relations. Doesn't matter what that is exactly. It's some symbols, and I can construct the whole group by multiplying together those symbols. And the part on the right here is some equations that this multiplication has to satisfy. Doesn't matter if you really understand what this symbolic stuff means. The point is, it's this abstract symbolic stuff, okay? And it describes a group, right? Here's another description of the same group. This group is the group of symmetries of a hexagon. Well, now all of a sudden you've got a physical picture. Oh, sorry, an octagon. Sorry, an octagon. I used to be a hexagon. I changed it to an octagon because I didn't want it to get confused with my robots. This has nothing to do with my robots. So it's the symmetries of an octagon. All right. And all of a sudden we now have a physical idea of what it is we're looking at here. All right. So for example, this R corresponds to a rotation. And the fact that r to the eighth equals 1 is just the statement that if I rotate 8 times, I get back to where I started. And the t corresponds to flipping across one of these lines. And if I flip twice, I get back to where I started, etc. So all of a sudden, all the symbols get meanings and the equations begin to be visual. And you really get a sort of a new view on what your group is. Right, so, of course, this is a easy group, and in geometric group theory, we mostly are dealing with infinite groups, and so life is much harder, but the idea is to find a physical representation, a geometric representation of the group, and it turns out that these cubical complexes are very useful for some, in fact, groups which can be modeled with cubical complexes are particularly nice, and we can do a lot with those. So whenever possible, we look for cubical complexes that can model them. By the way, there's no reason to mess up this hexagon, of course, octagon, because an octagon is a pretty nice space as it is. But if one really wanted to, one could replace each one of these quadrilaterals with a cube, and one would have a cubical complex which models the action of this group. All right. So if one wanted a cubical complex here, one could replace this with cubes. Okay, so that was all motivation. I'm going to spend the rest of the talk actually studying the geometry of these things. All right. What's geometry? What do we mean by geometry? Well, Well, what I mean by geometry is notions of some notion of distance, measuring the distance between two points, being able to find shortest paths between two points, looking at angles, like angles of triangles. What do you study in 10th grade geometry? Just what's the shortest path between two points? What are the angles, some of the angles of the triangle? That sort of thing, right? Just understanding the geometry. Okay. We're getting away from cubes for a minute. We'll come back to cubes. But just for the exercise of it, we're going to leave cubes for a minute. Distance. Now let's talk for a minute about the geometric object that consists just of the circle. And here I just mean the line, the circular line. All right? And I want to know what's the distance between the points X and Y. Well, there's really two possible right answers to this question. One right answer is that we could just measure in the plane, take out a ruler, and measure how far it is from here to here. And if this is the unit circle, then we would get square root of 2 as our distance. And the other answer is, no. You have to travel on the circle. It's like being on the Earth. We can't go through the center of the Earth. We want to get from here to Tokyo. You have to go around, all right? You have to travel on the circle. Well, in that case, it's the length of this arc, which is pi over 2. Okay, so my first rule number one, is I am only allowing in what I call intrinsic distances. That is, distances measured on the object. Why? Well, I want to turn my robot from this shape to this shape. It's pretty useless to talk about a path that doesn't go through allowable moves, right? Getting off the shape would be like, you know, what are we doing? What are you talking about? And I'm only interested in paths that travel inside my model, because those correspond to something going on in the physical system I'm modeling. Okay? So we have to understand always, when I talk about geometry, I'm always talking about things that can be measured by, you know, an ant living on this object. We're not allowed to leave the object to measure things. All right. In other words, by distance, we always mean the length of the shortest path from our initial point to our final point, a path that stays on our object. And those paths are called geodesic. Obviously, that word comes from differential geometry or physics or wherever you like that word to come from, geodesic meaning shortest path. So I'll refer to these as geodesic paths. Here's an example. So now I'm going to take my new object to be just this grid. Again, not the whole plane, just the grid. This is called the taxi cab distance. We want to get from X to Y, and we are a taxi cab. Well, we can't go. We have to stay on the streets, all right? So getting from X to Y is, let's call this unit length, is length 7, all right? But now an interesting point comes up. How many geodesics are there from X to Y? Lots. Any path of length 7 is a shortest path from X to Y. The taxi cab could have chosen to go up this way and across this way, same distance. Or for that matter, basically any path that goes up and to the right is going to be a shortest path. So we have the first cautionary note that unlike in the plane where there's a unique line connecting any two points, there may not be a unique geodesic connecting two points. Here's the worst case scenario. How many geodesics from point X to point Y on the sphere? Well, infinitely many. Every longitude line, you can go however you want as long as you go along a longitude line. All right, so there could even be infinitely many geodesics connecting two points. All right. Let's talk about angles. We'll move on to angles now. So we talked a little about shortest paths, geodesics. Let's talk about angles. Well, it turns out, and those of you who know something about, who had some contact with differential geometry know that the shape of triangles the shape of triangles turns out to be an interesting and important question, right? So what do I mean by a triangle? Well, by a triangle, I mean three points joined by shortest paths. Right? Just pick three points and join them by some choice of shortest path. There may be a choice. Pick one. Three shortest paths, all right? That's what I mean by triangle. And we can ask what the shape of a triangle is. Well, here are some pictures. In the first one, I've drawn a triangle on a sphere. And on a sphere, triangles, shortest paths follow our arcs of great circles. And so it's easy to see that these sort of bulge out. They look a little fatter than what we're used to drawing on the plane. And then there are other spaces, for example, a hyperboloid, that if you drew three shortest paths, you end up with a triangle that kind of looks thin, right? Well, these three pictures that I drew, the shapes of the triangles in this case depends on something that we call the curvature of the space. So a sphere is positively curved, curves outward, all right? The plane has no curvature, has zero curvature, it's flat, and a hyperboloid curves inward, has negative curvature. Well, it's possible to make those words very precise if you happen to be working on something called the Riemannian manifold and know differential geometry. But we are not working on a Riemannian manifold, and we're assuming we don't know anything about Riemannian geometry. But the wonderful thing is, a stroke of absolute brilliance, one of many, I should say, of Mikhail Gromov, building on some earlier work of Alexandrov, was to have the idea that what if we simply define a notion of curvature in terms of the shape of the triangle? Instead of defining curvature using some fancy differential geometry and then looking at triangles, what if we simply use the shape of triangles to define some notion of curvature? Right? So I'm going to do that. I am going to define for you what it means for some geometric object to be non-positively curved. So curvature zero or negative, non-positively curved, all right? So it should look like a flat or hyperboloid type of space. Well, the definition is simply that its triangles are thin, right? That's what I'm going to require, that the triangles look thin. So what does look thin mean? So look thin isn't quite right. They have to be thin. So what do we mean by be thin? So you'll see what I mean in a minute. So I have a triangle in my weirdo space, say my cubicle complex or on my sphere or on my whatever it is. I have some weird geometric object, and I draw a triangle on it. I take three points, and I draw shortest paths between them, geodesics between them. All right? I measure those three geodesics, how long they are, and I go to a nice flat piece of plate paper, ordinary old sheet of paper lying on the desk surface, and I draw a triangle with the same side lengths. All right? And the rule is that if I measure the distance across this triangle at any point, it should be less than or equal to the distance across the one on my piece of paper. So if I travel in my weird space, so this is some weird object, and traveling in a weird object from here to here should take less than or equal to the distance it would take to do the same thing on my flat piece of paper. That's the rule. That's what we mean by thin, thinner than, at least as thin as ordinary triangles. And we simply declare that condition to be what we mean by non-positive curvature. Excuse me, I have a little note to myself down here, and the note is this problem that mathematicians really hate to lie, you know? They really hate to not tell, you know, half-truths. And so let me just say something about the half-truth I'm telling you here. Non-positive curvature only requires that this be true for very small triangles. It's really a local condition. I am going to freely mix up the local condition with the global condition, and the reason I'm allowed to do this is that there is a very deep and difficult theorem that says the local condition, together with something called simply connected, implies the global condition. Or equivalently, you can always pass to something called the universal cover if all you have is local and it becomes global. There's a very easy way to get between knowing that small triangles are thin and knowing that all triangles are thin. And because of that, I am simply going to ignore the difference here and be very fuzzy about whether I'm talking about the small triangles or all triangles. Right, so that's just a warning. Okay, so let's get back to our cubes, our cubical complexes. So the question is, what does it, does this condition, does this thin triangle condition hold in our cubical complexes, right? Which cubical complexes are thin and which ones aren't? And if they are, why do we care? So that'll be the second part. But let's first try and get our brains around this idea of thin triangles, right? So we're going to practice here. All right. Ready? Let's start in the one-dimensional case. All right. Supposing I have just a graph, all right? And let's say this graph is a tree, which means that there are no circuits. Nothing goes around the circle, all right? There's no things that come all the way around the circuit, all right? That's called a tree. So supposing I have a tree, and I want to know what triangles in the tree look like. So I've picked out 3 points, X, Y, and Z, and we want to connect them with shortest paths. Yeah? See the shortest paths in your mind? There they are. All right? So shortest path there, shortest path there, and shortest path there. All right? Now take out a piece of paper and draw me a triangle that has those three side lengths. Yeah? Those three side lengths. What does that triangle look like? Well, more like that, right? Yeah? But measure that distance, that distance, that's that and that, and this distance is that. Right? Well, pretty clearly, this guy's thinner than this guy. In fact, this guy's completely collapsed down into a tripod. It's not even a triangle. It's so thin. Right? Very, very thin. The distance across this triangle is zero, basically. It's completely collapsed. Okay, so definitely thin triangles. Let's go up a dimension. Let's try some spaces, build some spaces out of squares. Right? Well, here are three squares coming together at a corner, and I've picked 3 points. And I've picked them rather cleverly, probably too cleverly, but the 3 points I pick, once again, have a tripod as a triangle, completely collapse, and the corresponding thing in the plane would look more like this. Now, of course, if I move these points a little, it wouldn't be completely collapsed, but it would still be pretty thin. If I move this down a little, this would come a little bit at an angle, and this would come a little bit at an angle. They'd still be really, really thin, right? They wouldn't be completely collapsed. So again, nice and thin, my triangles. All right? Let's put together some squares so that they don't meet at, so in the previous squares that they met at an edge, now we're putting together squares that meet at a vertex. Well, four squares meeting at a vertex, hey, that's just a flat piece of paper, no problem whatsoever. All right? And triangles are just flat, ordinary. How about five squares meeting at a vertex? I made one of these. You've got to make, if anybody's interested in this, you have to make one of these and play with it. It's the only way to figure this out. So here's all, these you can actually make. So all I did was take, you just take a piece of paper, divide it into four squares, slit it open, right, slit it open along one of those lines, and insert an extra square with some tape, right? Okay, got five squares coming around that vertex, right? Now, I picked 3 points. Let's draw the triangle connecting them. Well, this is pretty clearly just an ornate straight line. This is an ornate straight line. But what's the shortest path from here to there? Down and across, right? Again, way thinner than if it was in an, if this thing was just a flat, then it would have gone straight across, but it couldn't. So it had to go down and across. So it's, again, thin. It's really actually fun to play with these. Any triangle, take any 3 points and draw triangles between them. If the 3 points are, you know, way out here somewhere, it's just going to be an ordinary flat triangle. But as soon as this sort of singular point in the middle gets involved, your triangles are always going to come out way thinner than you thought they ought to be, right? They're always going to be thin. So see how this has a sort of kind of like a saddle shape? This is, people who are familiar with hyperbolic geometry, what we've got here is kind of, it's not really hyperbolic space because it has a singular point, but it behaves a lot like a hyperbolic space. We've got something that's behaving like a negatively curved space, but it's singular. It's not a smoothly negatively curved. But it basically, what we're seeing here is negative curvature. All right, so, okay, looks like we're in good shape. We're putting together lots of squares, and the triangles are all thin. Well, let's try one more. All right, So this time I put together three squares at a vertex. So it looks like the corner of a cube, but I'm only taking the surface of the cube. There's nothing in the middle here. All right, this particular cube has no interior. It's just the surface. I've drawn you a triangle. That triangle looks ordinary. Looks like a triangle in a plane. In fact, I could draw a triangle exactly like that. I could slice this open, right, and draw a triangle exactly like that. But how far is it to get from a point here to a point here? I can't slice through the middle. I'm not allowed to go inside the cube. I have to travel on the surface. So getting across that requires going up and over, which is too far. It's farther than it would be if I drew that in the plane. All right, so even though it looks like it's thin enough, it's not, because distances have to be measured on the surface that we're working on. All right, so it doesn't always work. So this is bad. Curvature's this is the non-positive curvature condition fails. It has a bad triangle in it. Okay, the good news, and here is Gromov's name again. He introduced this notion of curvature, and he showed that if you build a space, I'm stating it just for squares right now, but I'll tell you what happens in higher dimensions in a minute. If you build a space out of squares, that's the only thing that can go wrong. So as long as you don't see three squares coming together in like a corner like that, as long as that never happens, one of those little corners, then the whole space is non-positively curved. Again, locally, and if it's simply connected, then globally. So it's so you just have to look out for these little three square corners, right? That's not too hard to prove. The nice thing is that there's an equally easy condition that works in higher dimensions, in any dimension whatsoever. So if I build a space out of any dimensional cubes, I essentially just have to look out for empty corners. Empty corners mean something that looks like a corner of the next higher dimensional cube, but the interior is missing. All right, and this turns out to be something that can be described combinatorially, is easily checked, and it's either true or it isn't true, but it's something that you can concretely test for and say, yes, it works, or no, it doesn't work. So you just have to look for empty corners, and if there aren't any, then the whole thing works. Everything works. Okay, so, good news. Let's go back to our robots. One of the things that Greisman and Peterson show is by construction of these configuration spaces, you never have these empty corners. That depends on their precise definition of what it means to be independent moves, but they're nicely designed so that you never, ever have these empty corners. In other words, this non-positive curvature business always works in those models. So we have this nice condition. That's good. So what? So now we know this nice property of the geometry. How can we use it? What does it tell us? So my claim is that non-positive curvature says that the geometry behaves nicely. That the sort of nasty things that might happen, like too many geodesics and things like that, don't happen if you have this non-positive curvature condition. So let's see a few properties. All right. So let's say, I'm using X again for my object. I have this big complicated object built out of cubes. And let's say that I've checked and it's non-positively curved. Triangles are all thin. And now we'll say all the triangles are thin. So triangles are all thin. So my first claim is we never have this problem of two shortest paths, two geodesics. Remember those taxicabs and that sphere where we had lots of ways to get the shortest ways to get from point X to point Y? Doesn't happen, right? Why doesn't it happen? Well, it's a math problem. We're going to do proof, all right? It's a one-liner, but let's do a proof. All right, so let's say there were two. Let's say I have point X, point Y, and let's say there were two shortest ways to get there. Right? Here's one, and here's another. Right? Well, I'm just going to pick a point, maybe the midpoint, doesn't matter, any point, and call it Z. Maybe it's the midpoint of one of these paths. Right? Well, I claim that what we're looking at now is a triangle by my definition. It's three points, shortest path, shortest path, shortest path. All right? So it's a triangle. So, if I'm non-positively curved, it has to be at least as thin as the triangle I would draw in the plane. corresponding to that. So what's the triangle in the plane look like? Well, in the plane, what I do is I measure these three sides, and I draw a triangle with exactly those side lengths. Yeah, can you imagine doing that? What happens? It completely collapses because this plus this equals this. They're both the same length. So getting here plus here equals here, it's a completely collapsed triangle. But there's no way this is thinner than this unless the top line is the bottom line. All right? Proof. Okay, so if you have thin triangles, then you have unique geodesics, unique shortest paths. Okay, let's do another property. This one is, as I'll discuss, is particularly useful for sort of statistical data. So there are various ways of averaging. When you have statistical data, you want to find some kind of mean. You know, you want to find the best guess, you know, in all this data, right? Some kind of mean. So how do you find a mean when you've got a bunch of points on some weird object? What do you mean by the best? Or here's another way of thinking. Let's reinterpret this in terms of my robot. Okay, now I have a robot, and the robot's swatting flies. Right? Robot's swatting flies. And so, you know, it has to be able to get very quickly from here and here and here and here. And so we statistically look at where the flies are. Right? And we plot where the flies. More flies maybe over here than over here. And we want to know what's the best sort of central position for this hand to be in to be able to get quickly to those flies. All right? So it's some kind of averaging of where it should be to get in most, to be able to most quickly get to all the flies it has to swat. Well, there's two notions. The first is the center. So in the flying flies example, what you might want to do, so here's where the flies are all. And so this is just some blob. This is my X, my cube complex. And the flies are in this range, in this region. And the robot needs to get to these places to swat the flies. So you could say that the best place would be the point which minimizes the distance to all the rest of that. That's what's called the center. You just want to minimize you want to sort of draw a circle around this and take the center of that. But of course, this is not so easy to do when your space looks like that and your flies are here, 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 and here. Where's the center, guys? It's not so obvious anymore. Okay? Well, it turns out non-positive curvature guarantees that there is a unique center and gives you some control over how to find it. Right? Guarantees that there is indeed a unique center and gives you some methods for locating that center. All right, another concept, which is better for statistical data, is a concept of centroid. So let's say my flies, there are a lot more, twice as many over here as over here. I might not want my robot right in the middle. I might want him to list to the sides. So he's more ready to, you know, when you're averaging statistical data, you have to take into account not just where it is, but how much of it is over here and how much of it is over there, right? So we want to average the statistical data somehow. All right, so here's a way to average in a geometric space, average where this is. We're going to connect we're going to take all the points we're looking at. I've only drawn three, but imagine there are thousands, and connect them all up by lines between them, and take the midpoints of all those lines. Throw away the original three points and save the new ones, the red ones, the midpoints. All right, now repeat. Now repeat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't draw enough, but you can see it's starting to converge somewhere, and it's going to converge, you know, somewhere closer to this end than that end, right? So what does non-positive curvature do for us? Non-positive curvature guarantees that this process always converges, that you really do get a point that is best. All right, it doesn't start bouncing around and trying to go in two different places, so it always converges. Okay, so the moral of the story is that, your reaction to this might be, well, that's not surprising, is it? I mean, you expect things to converge into. The moral of the story is bad things don't happen. That if you have non-positive curvature, the things that you're used to being true in ordinary Euclidean space probably still hold on this weird space, all right? It's that as weird as it looks, it actually behaves non-weirdly. Whereas it's easy to construct spaces with positive curvature, that do all kinds of crazy things. So we have a weird looking object, and yet the sort of geometry we're used to doing, say, in the plane still works. That's really the philosophy here. All right. Okay. Well, I guess I already said some of this before. I'm just really recapping now. So in particular, if we have a space which models our physical system and it's non-positively curved, then we have unique geodesics. If it's globally non-positively curved, we have unique geodesics, and these correspond to the most efficient paths of getting from one place to another, like one configuration to another. And what I didn't mention, but is also happens to be true with these cubical complexes, is they have enough structure that one can actually write down algorithms for finding these optimal paths. All right. This is actually an algorithmic process you can do to locate the shortest path. So that's more in the, that's another aspect of this theory, which I haven't really talked about. We can find the shortest paths. We can then ask how long these shortest paths are, etc. So all of these properties we've been studying now translate back into saying something about the physical system we are modeling. If what we are modeling was phylogenetic data, then this gives us a way to average our statistical data and pick out a best point using centroids. So all of these properties I was talking about give us some information about the system we started with. So I guess that's really all I have to say, because I want to just end with the conclusions that I've given you an example of modeling physical systems with geometry. There are many, many more examples out there. Some of them, cubes aren't the right thing. I mean, it might be some other geometric object, but the idea that you can take complex data and model it using a geometric object and then study the geometry to understand the thing you're modeling, I think is something that has a lot more potential to it than is only really starting to be fully explored now. And I think we'll see a lot more exciting stuff going on of this nature. And finally, for those of us who do it for fun, that the geometry of these spaces is strange, complicated, and a lot of fun to study. So I'm going to end there. Thanks.